Good evening, and welcome to tonight's event, Getting to Green, Pennsylvania's Commitment to Renewable Energy. My name is Katie McClellan, and I'm a student supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues, the sponsor of tonight's event. Many Dickinson students were caught off guard by this year's change to daylight savings time, approximately 3 weeks earlier than previous years. As one component of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, this time change was designed to save energy based on the decreased consumption of electricity in the evening if it stays light longer. Representatives Edward Markey of Massachusetts and Fred Upton of Michigan, the sponsors of this amendment to the Energy Policy Act, estimated that it would save $4.4 billion in energy bills by the year 2020. However, many environmentalists argue that the complex energy crisis faced by this country and the world will not be solved with simple time changes, but will instead require major policy shifts to promote the use of alternative energy sources. One such policy shift here in Pennsylvania was the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard, signed into law in November of 2004 as Act 213. Generally, Act 213 requires that electric energy suppliers increase over time the percentage of the energy they supply that is generated by alternative energy sources. This bill has drawn criticism, however, for including environmentally controversial energy sources alongside low-carbon renewable sources, as well as for not placing high enough requirements on the amount of renewable energy used. Tonight, our speakers include Michael Ewall, Thomas Tuffy, and moderator Michael Hyman. Mike Ewall has been involved in grassroots environmental justice organizing since 1991. He is founder of Action PA and the Energy Justice Network, working in Pennsylvania and globally to help grassroots community groups tackle polluting energy and waste industries. From defeating two incinerator projects in his home county near Philadelphia, to helping halt a nuclear waste dump that was to be built in Pennsylvania in the 1990s, Mr. Ewall's grassroots support work has helped many communities achieve victories against polluters. Thomas Tuffy is the director of the Center for Energy, Enterprise, and the Environment at Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future. With previous experience in both environmental policy and education, he is a former executive director of the Sustainable Energy Fund of Central Eastern Pennsylvania, an executive committee member of the Clean Energy States Alliance, and faculty member at Rutgers University. Dr. Tuffy received his doctoral degree in environmental sciences from Rutgers University. Our moderator this evening is Michael Hyman, a professor of environmental studies and geography here at Dickinson College. After receiving his doctoral degree in geography from the University of California at Berkeley, he has used his training in both the natural and social sciences to research solid, hazardous, and nuclear waste management, sustainable development, and environmental racism and justice. Here at Dickinson, he teaches courses on environmental disruption and policy analysis, the Environmental Studies Advanced Topics Seminar on Energy, and the Luce Field Course. Before we begin, I ask that you please turn off all cell phones and pagers. After the presentation, there will be a brief question and answer period. Because we are filming this event, and out of courtesy to those among us who may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before you pose your question. Now, please join me in welcoming Michael Ewall, Thomas Tuffy, and Michael Hyman.
Okay, can I stay in my seat? Can you hear me? I guess this is on. I'll start off by saying that welcome. This is a really interesting small group, but a very interesting group. I may not know all of you, but I recognize quite a few of you. And I want to point out that we have members here from a wide variety of different communities. We have retired engineers among us today. We have retired faculty who were instrumental in actually founding the environmental studies program here at Dickinson. We have students who are both ES majors and soon-to-be environmental studies majors. We have fellow geographers and also head of the Clark Center. We have with us members of the Dickinson physical plant. You may know that the physical plant here is involved in producing biodiesel from our recycled waste oil here on campus and from local restaurants nearby, and soon will be involved in installing something between $250,000 and $500,000 worth of photovoltaic cells on the top of the physical plant or the Kaufman building. We're not sure yet where. We have members of the Pennsylvania's very strong and influential labor community among us today, the AFL-CIO. And I'm not sure. We have members of the environmental community, Pennsylvania Audubon in particular, but others among you. So this is a very, very diverse group. I'm very pleased that the two people with us today are some of the most interesting people I've ever met. Mr. Tuffy, actually, I found out, was a fellow activist during the first Earth Day. That's how far back we go, when he was a student at Rutgers University, where he stayed on long enough to get his PhD and moved on to become an entrepreneur in the area of environmental energy. And we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. Mike Ewall, whom I've known for over a decade, has been a frequent visitor to campus, where he manages very often when he stays overnight to sleep on the treehouse floor, as well as my basement. And in fact, Mike is carrying with him today one of those, you know, those plastic cups that we have in the snar that are supposedly made out of corn? Well, it turns out that the bottom of the cup is a number 7 on it, which means kind of plastic you can't really recycle. Now, we know that those plastic cups supposedly can be composted, and Mike is carrying the cup with him today. He didn't know what to do with it after he drank from it. He's going to take it home and compost it and see if it really works. So without further ado, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to hear from both of our distinguished speakers for about 20 minutes each, starting with Mr. Tuffy, Tom Tuffy, and then we're going to open up the floor after that discussion to everyone, and we'll just take it from there. So we'll start off with Tom Tuffy.
Thank you, Professor Michael. Now, anybody that can make biodiesel on campus, I spoke to these guys before. Trust me, they also know how to make vodka. So on the side, expect this vodka operation. It's correct. 100 years ago, I was a student activist, and I spent 4 years on faculty, and then I went off into business. And I spent 30 years in business, and 6 years ago, I came into the nonprofit work, kind of that point in life. First 4 of those years, really managing money from the deregulation of the electric utilities, investing in clean energy companies and projects. Last couple of years, doing this advocacy work. What that means is I don't know nearly as much about the advocacy policy wonk stuff as I do about how to make businesses work. So what do you think I bring to the equation of this clean energy stuff? I understand what the small companies go through. So my approach to this is this energy enterprise and environment. I believe I want to reach an environmental goal and a clean energy goal, and I happen to think the best way to do that is to understand the early stage companies and help them so that they can make things work. That, to me, is the most sustainable way to make things go. I position for things that are going to happen soon. I spent a whole bunch of my life doing projects that never got built. I like things that are going to make a difference in 20 months. 20 years is completely legitimate, but where I concentrate is 20 months. What I want to do tonight is not talk to the vodka makers as much as I really want to talk to the students, because I want you to be aware at what point in time and space you're at. There is a tremendous opportunity for you to do something meaningful for all of your career in this clean energy area. Nothing is more immense. In the United States, we purchase about $500 billion a year of fuel of different kinds. One of the many generational differences I've discovered is when I was younger, a million was a big deal to me. It was. I got to talk in billions anymore. We purchase $500 billion in fuel, and then we purchase about another $500 billion in different devices. And it might be a solar panel, or it might be an engine to burn that fuel. It might be a wind farm, might be a coal-fired plant, might be whatever. But you're talking about a tremendous amount of money. What's the size of the U.S. budget? It's about $3 trillion. Energy, huge. Everything that we did today has energy somewhere's underlying it. Yet, it's a 100-year-old model. And the energy that we have had in Pennsylvania has been abundant and cheap and dirty and not necessarily so secure. What is the entire world doing? But moving now to a different kind of energy into the future that hopefully is going to be abundant, affordable, clean, we're going to think about it. Most of us don't think about energy at all. Now, you guys are the choir. You're here. But for the most part, people don't think about energy. It's in the background. Not going to be the case going forward. So, the argument I'm making is that you are on the forefront of this transformation. And if it's something that turns you on, pay some time and attention to it, because you can spend your career here, and it'll be a meaningful career to you. That's time. Space. Why Pennsylvania? Pennsylvania is an immense energy state. We have, and I'm talking electric power for the moment, we'll get back to vodka later. We have in Pennsylvania 46,000 megawatts of electric power generation. How much wind do we have? 46,000 total, right? That is roughly 60% coal, 40% nuclear, and I'm lying a bit. Coal is probably 55%, but think numbers like that. 46,000 megawatts, 185 megawatts of wind, one of solar. So really at the front edge. One of the ways that we think about energy is now, and we'll come back to this, but the climate issues and the carbon that comes from this power generation. One of the ways of saying, where is Pennsylvania in the space part of that time and space equation, is to say, where are we in carbon from coal-fired or electric power generation, including nuclear? And one way of doing that is we compare ourselves to others. So let's compare ourselves to New Jersey. And we're comparing the carbon emissions from coal and nuclear power generation to New Jersey. It's not going to work. We have to add New York. We have to compare Pennsylvania to New York and New Jersey. But it's still not going to work. We have to add in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire. If we take those seven states combined, we can compare Pennsylvania to those seven states combined, and we're 30% more than those seven states combined. You get the picture of how big we are? Now, by the way, from a geopolitics standpoint, here, you're paying about 8 cents kilowatt hour. In those states, you're paying 12 and 13 cents kilowatt hour. How long do you think that geopolitic will last? Time, space. And the space is, Pennsylvania is a huge piece of the energy equation. And we're doing things. Come back on time. What are the drivers here? And the first driver, and literally, I've been in this environmental in one way or the other in energy for 40 plus years. And I happen to, Mike knows, I'm privileged to have another home in the upstate New York area in the Adirondacks and a lake. And I drive around and my neighbors have signs on their cars that says, stop acid rain. And we have lakes that are dead. That comes from Pennsylvania and Ohio, environmental emissions from coal-fired generation. Now, those environmental aspects can, you know, whack the outside of a building, they can cause smog. But, you know, I've been dealing with that for 40 years and hasn't made any change yet. Environment. Health. Those coal plants emit small particulate matter. Small particulate matter is more of a problem than big because when I suck it in, it stays sucked in. So if we're looking in Pennsylvania, some 30,000 asthma attacks a year, like 3,000 heart attacks, big time mercury in our food stream in childbearing women. But you know what? We've had those health problems for years too. Hasn't really made a lot happen. What's new to the equation? Climate. The number of people denying climate is diminishing, but we still have the issues of, is climate change occurring, global warming? What part is man, and what do you do about it? Now, depending upon who you are, you may react to different pieces. Part of the climate is the polar bears are in trouble. You may react to that. part of the climate issue is you may look at the mountain vistas, which I do, and they're going to change in the future. And the species are going to change. But I also happen to believe that when it hits people's pocketbooks, it makes a difference. So if you happen to live on the shore, you'll find that your insurance premiums have tripled. If you're a major corporation, you may find that there are now people saying, what are you going to do about carbon in the future? Because we're afraid that if you don't do smart things, we're just getting financial obligations and liabilities. There was a huge deal that fell apart 3 weeks ago because of the amount of coal-fired generation in the deal until they get rid of two-thirds, three-quarters of the projects. So climate is now coming in and starting to get traction. What else? That. 1996, Pennsylvania deregulated, meaning restructured the utilities and put caps on generation rates. Those caps come off the end of this decade. I'm sure you don't realize that that's been the case. I'm sure you don't realize that in the cost there are things like stranded nuclear power costs. But when those caps come off in Maryland, rates went up in one fell swoop 57%. When they came off in Maryland, they went up 70%. I'm not expecting quite that here, but you know what? You should not expect that you're going to enjoy this cheap power into the future like you have in the past. That gets people's attention. And the last thing is a huge issue. It's what's driving biofuels: energy security. And it's simply when I get up in the morning and I want to hear about how many people were killed in Iraq. And I don't know about you, but I don't really believe we're there to bring democracy to the Iraqis. I think we're there for a critical reason, and that's to protect the energy security of the country. But you know what? I don't want to have to worry about the energy security of the country. I'd rather get off that stuff. That is a huge driver for this energy transformation to clean energy markets. Huge. Presidential elections coming up, it'll be one of the two or three dominant themes. They'll be tripping over themselves to take positions on this. So the drivers, environment, health, climate, cost, energy security, and a couple of those are new. Again, it means I think we're past the tipping point, and you're looking at an immense part of our society, and I think we're now moving forward. You can participate in that. You can make a contribution. It can be meaningful. You can make a very good living. What is society doing about it? Interestingly, I've always been associated somehow with environment and energy, but 6 and 7 years ago, if you had told me that wind is coming into Pennsylvania, I would have been very dismissive. You probably would have punched me in the nose, and I would have said, poo-poo, Sonny. You know, that's something out west where they get the wind. Poo-poo, chicky. I was wrong. We have demand here. And the voluntary demand of universities like this, reaching into their pocket and buying wind energy, gave us about 185 megawatts of wind energy. 185 megawatts in Pennsylvania is, what, 40,000 homes, approximately. Well, let's look at the voluntary market. But then we said in 1996, we had deregulation. Deregulation brought us competition. 2004, alternative energy portfolio standard that was referred to by Katie, brought us clean energy and something called distributed generation. What was the old model? You plunked out a big old massive power plant here and you radiated out from it, and if you didn't like it, too bad, chicky. This is the law that allowed you to do individual distributed projects. Passed in 2004, we're still working on the rules to implement it, but we're largely there. That was that piece. The governor, 2 months ago, announced the Energy Independence Strategy. And it said things like the utilities will have to buy energy efficiency as well as new generation. Get me a glass of vodka later, and we can talk about what that means. It said that the utilities are going to have to install advanced meters. When you walk in my house, it's got every electronic gizmo under the sun. I mean, who's got an old crank-up clock anymore, right? You know, you got all kinds of electric. Kim does. We don't have, you do here in PPL. It's the only utility in the state. You have actually advanced meters. The only utility in the state that has it. Why is that important? In Pennsylvania, we peak 2 times a year in terms of energy demand. We peak in the summer, August, hot as can be, air conditioners are blasting. And then we peak in the winter, like it was a couple weeks ago, cold as can be and the wind's whistling. When we hit that peak time, the power that has to come on is incredible, and the cost of the power goes through the ceiling. So when you come home and you do that dinner in August, and after dinner you turn on the dishwasher, that power is 25, 30 times more expensive than it is in any other time. Except you don't know it, right? Because your cost at that moment didn't change. It smooched out over the entire year's bill that you're paying. And in a hot year, that's 20% of your bill. Plus, all that power is being demanded at once. When do we have rolling blackouts? When you hit that kind of situation. But if you had a signal that said, it's going to cost you a fortune, Professor Mike, to turn the dishwasher on now versus turning it on at 11 o'clock at night, he'd probably turn it on at 11 o'clock at night. That's a piece of what we have coming at us. Carbon. And I'm really zipping 100,000-foot elevation through a bunch of this. But all I'm saying is you're at the right point in time and space. It's going to be immense. It's going to be meaningful. The laws and regulations are stacking up. The financial community is stacking up. Literally billions of dollars pouring into these technologies. Carbon. All bets are going to be off. And the governor has announced that he'll announce a carbon policy the end of April, beginning of May. We'll see. I think he will. But if it's not this governor, because there's going to be a hell of a budget fight, it'll be a next governor, or the governor over, or it's going to be the feds. But carbon and carbon policies and some form of carbon cost is coming at us. Why did the deal that I mentioned before go south? And that was Goldman Sachs financing Texas utilities and canceling 9 of 13 power plants or whatever the number was, coal-fired power plants. Every aspect, people are now looking at carbon. What's going to happen with carbon? I guarantee you, no matter where you go to look at how to address carbon, energy conservation and efficiency, when was the last time you saw anything from PPL to encourage you to conserve? You just answered. You know why? You're paying that fixed rate. And the fixed rate per kilowatt hour includes the fixed charge for the wires as well as the variable fuel charge. So if you conserve, you're nicking them on the cost they have to recover on the wires. So they're not going to encourage you to do it unless they have to or we change the model. But I guarantee you that what's coming at us are real energy conservation and efficiency programs, because we have to now. More renewable energy, and then more biodiesel type stuff. When you reach into the ground and pull up ancient petroleum and burn it, you're putting new carbon into the atmosphere. If you grow soybeans and you capture carbon and then you burn carbon, it's neutral. So if I take and replace 20% of my diesel with biodiesel, I've saved myself from the carbon equation. Are there other issues? Absolutely. Every one of these technologies has costs. Everyone has issues. You're going to have to work on them. There's lots to be done. There's stuff to do good, and there's stuff to do bad, and we've got to do it good. But if you really are interested in something that's meaningful, you're right on the early edge. it's going to take decades to do, so there's plenty of time. I better shut up. Thank you, Professor Mike.
Thank you, Tom. I want to point out that we are here on campus are acutely aware that the rate caps are coming off, and we're acutely aware that our energy bills will be going up. And that's why Mr. Ellerman and his staff are involved in actually upgrading our energy plant here, right? And we're going to have a much more efficient, very soon online, energy plant, main power plant on campus. So even as the rates are going up, hopefully we'll be using less of that fuel. Next, we have Mike Ewald with us, and he's going to be giving us one of any number of presentations up here that he's prepared, depending on the audience.
Okay. I'm going to give you a hodgepodge of a bit of other presentations, but in 20 minutes, I can't give you for any one of them. But I'll start off by telling you who I am. My name is Mike Ewald. I live in Philadelphia, and I run two nonprofit organizations. One is called Action PA, which is a statewide environmental group. Another one is called Energy Justice Network, which is national, somewhat international. And both groups work to protect communities that are threatened by polluting industries, particularly waste and energy-related facilities, things like power plants, incinerators, ethanol and other refineries, landfills, all sorts of things like that. So we've been kept quite busy in Pennsylvania, given all the crazy things that we have in this state. I've worked on the Harrisburg incinerator issue and many others in this region. And we've been working increasingly nationally and beyond to help communities all over the place address some of these problems. Now, we also work very closely with students. I have a pretty long history of working with the Student Environmental Action Coalition, which is a national group based in Pennsylvania. And they've worked with the group here over the years and many other places as well. And so we have a lot of student organizing skills and resources that I can lend as well. So I just want to put that out there and also quickly put a plug in for a national, or actually binational, U.S. and Canada coalition that we helped form a few years ago called the Energy Action Coalition. And there are 30 groups working with students and youth on energy and climate issues in the U.S. and Canada. And ours is part of that. The Student Environmental Action Coalition is also part of that. If you go to energyaction.net, you can find them online. And there's a lot of good resources through there as well. So first, I want to pass around this crazy chart so I have time to get around, and then see which of my many PowerPoint presentations I need to be showing. Where's that button down there? Okay, this has what I need. Okay. So I'm just going to walk you through the beginning piece of a larger presentation I do on energy and environmental racism issues. And we'll just then get into some of the things that can apply to this campus and some of the issues around energy security and what can be done on a campus level. Now, we're in the middle of a major energy transition. Basically, we have the issues of peak oil and gas. Raise your hand if you heard of peak oil. Okay. Peak oil is basically the you are here thing in the first one. Basically, global oil production. We're at the peak that we'll ever see in this planet. Some argue about whether it was last year or if it's several years from now, but we're somewhere around that peak time. We're not going to see any more oil pumped out of the ground in a given year than we're already seeing around now. And so that means things like oil prices having tripled in recent years as a consequence of that. Regionally, we're seeing in natural gas the same sort of thing. In North America, just like in the 70s we were with oil, where oil production peaked in North America and we started having to import it from other countries a lot, we're at that point now with natural gas. We're drilling more and more, we're not finding more and more, and we're starting to have to build liquefied natural gas terminals in order to maintain that addiction. They tried to build one even in Philadelphia. We helped stop that proposal. But they want to be able to import it from other countries so we can go to war for gas as well as oil. Now, the energy bill that was passed in 2005 had a lot of things. It was like a Christmas tree of dirty energy ideas and a few clean things thrown in. But for the most part, every bit of bonanza of dirty energy technologies was being subsidized through that bill. So that has a lot to do with what we're seeing on the ground. Of course, global warming and the politics around that and the reality around that have a lot to do with what's going on in the energy world. And then this here is a chart of rising coal prices. They've doubled in just the past few years, but oil and gas prices have tripled since the late 90s. And so all of that is making both the clean and dirty alternatives more viable. Now, right now, this is a little outdated. The nuclear reactor is now up to 35. But this is what we're looking at right now. Every single state in the U.S. is being targeted. There are proposals for new nuclear reactors, new coal plants, new ethanol plants. That number is a little low. Now it's probably around 200 to 300. Almost all of them will be coal-fired with their little own coal plant inside them. We have many liquefied natural gas terminals, at least three now oil refineries. They just announced another proposal. Many coal-to-oil refineries, some proposed here in Pennsylvania, and numerous other schemes for incinerators and other dirty energy technologies. So what we do is basically we work with the grassroots. We work with the folks like this and their parents who are fighting back against these dirty energy developments. Most of the environmental movement is the grassroots volunteers out there, not the big groups that can afford to advertise at you and sell you calendars and things like that, but the mom-and-pop concerned citizens of tiny town Pennsylvania that are fighting back against big companies that are trying to pollute them. And that's the most effective weapon against these industries. It's not some of the big groups in offices in D.C. that are lobbying and stopping all these different power plants that are proposed around the country, like the 1,000 nuclear reactors they want to build by year 2000 in the 70s, and they got 10% of that built. And a lot of those have shut down. They got 116. They're down 103 now. So 90% of that industry didn't happen, and that was one community at a time. And that's the kind of work that we do, is help communities, one community at a time, connect with each other and decimate entire percentages of these dirty energy industries so that we can shape the energy industry and make it more viable for clean energies to compete so that the dirty things aren't polluting communities. So what you have in front of you is that crazy chart here that is more readable in front of you than up here, I'm sure. So I just wanted to walk you through that in a moment. And also, this kind of runs a corollary to it. This is where energy comes from in the U.S. There's three major sectors. There's electricity, and then there's transportation and heating fuels. Some of that is interchangeable, because you have some fuels that go in both sectors, but some don't. Like nuclear power is just in the electricity sector. And you can see big changes between them. So transportation is 97% oil. Whereas if you talk about oil and electricity, like politicians sometimes get confused and talk about blackouts in California and the Arctic Refuge in the same sentence, it doesn't make sense because oil is only about 2% of our electricity supply. So what you'll see in that crazy chart in front of you, or across the top you'll see the solid waste scheme of the solutions and the problems, and you'll see the three R's in there. There's actually a fourth R I added, but what are the three R's? We all know the three R's, right? Who knows the three R's? Great. So reduce, reuse, recycle, and they're in a priority order for a reason, right? Reducing is better than reusing is better than recycling. And oftentimes, as activists, we jump straight to recycling anyway. You see the same thing in the energy world, but the energy solutions are conservation, efficiency, and clean energy. And those correlate with reduce, reuse, recycle. It's the same basic concept. And so in there, you'll see in the lines, in the second, third lines, what those solutions versus problems are in the energy sectors of transportation, heating on the one line, and electricity on the other. Now, I won't get into that more unless you ask me questions, but I just want to put that out there as a framework for some of this. And as we're going forward, I'll also pass this around. This is about our clean, renewable energy solutions. So in as much as we can fit all the solutions to our energy problems in two sides of a page, that's what this is. It's obviously a lot more complicated than two sides of a page, though, so we have a whole box full of other handouts if you want to know more on other topics. But basically, I wanted to get into some things that specifically hit home for this campus and some of the things that have been advocated here. And so I want to start off by talking about this carbon neutrality idea. There's a lot of folks now that are focusing on carbon neutrality and global warming as if global warming is the only issue. It's a really important issue, but it's not the only issue. Carbon and carbon dioxide emissions is not the only pollutant that's out there. And so it makes it sometimes difficult when we develop policies that are very focused in a way where it doesn't look at the whole picture. And the carbon neutrality framework has some of those problems in that when you look at it just in that lens, then you can lend yourself to solutions like saying, gee, if we get our electricity sector getting its power 100% from nuclear energy, then is that carbon neutral? I mean, even though it's not, there's greenhouse gas emissions in the nuclear fuel cycle, but assuming that they're ignored, which they often are, then is that the kind of solution that you want at Dickinson or not? And there's a lot of other loopholes in there, and that might sound crazy as if, like, who would consider nuclear power in answer to that? Well, the answer is the Department of Energy would. They have a voluntary greenhouse gas reduction program, and the largest single category of greenhouse gas reductions that's in their annual reporting is from increased nuclear power generation. Okay, so that's not a fantasy of loophole of something that might happen. This is already being developed as policy and has been for a decade at least in that program of the Department of Energy. You'll also find, if you look through that program, examples of tire incineration qualifying, biotech tree, well, not biotech yet, but monoculture tree plantations, and the direction they're heading in is biotech tree plantations for this sort of thing. The burning of toxic landfill gas, which has mercury concentrations comparable to what you'll find in the coal plant, power plant exhaust. That's been documented by federal government researchers as well, not to mention the dioxin emissions and other toxic compounds that come out of there. Recycling of coal plant fly ash into cement where it's unlabeled. You don't realize that when they're busting up cement on the highway later and you have all this toxic dust coming out that they should be wearing protection and containerizing that stuff. And all kinds of biomass and biofuels technologies that are often passed off as if they're clean, green, renewable, carbon neutral when the impacts are actually far more dangerous than you might assume and things that we really shouldn't be moving towards as solutions. So the same sort of loopholes you'll find in a lot of areas of policy, the same kind of things apply with the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard that was passed by this state. Our governor has gone around and touted that as if it's the best thing ever. He calls it one of the most progressive in the nation, when in fact it set a precedent for the first one in the country that includes fossil fuels blatantly in what is otherwise a renewable energy law, inspiring five other states actually to consider doing the same, to consider waste coal being the equivalent to renewable energy. We also have gasification-style coal plants and coal mine methane in this bill. So we like hit rock bottom in terms of bad ideas that could be slipped into a renewable energy bill, except Virginia might try to one-up us. They are working on passing something that would allow nuclear power to be quasi-renewable in such a law. So basically, it's very important to get to the details of these types of policies, whether we're talking carbon neutrality, whether we're talking portfolio standards and what's going on statewide. The devil is always in those details, and it's really important to look out for the community impacts of things and look beyond just the typical public relations of what technologies are supposed to be. So when you hear that there's net CO2, zero emissions from biodiesel or ethanol or whatever else, look beyond that. Be like, well, what else is there besides CO2? And is it really net zero? And what about biotech pollution from the feedstocks that they need to grow these things? And what about the fuel versus food issues? And there's a whole bunch of things out there that unless you dig in and look for them, you're not going to find them. They're not going to be advertised in the products that are out there that you can consume. So on biodiesel, let me pass something out on that since that's something the school is pursuing. And your school is pursuing a cleaner version than when I wrote that fact sheet up about. I understand the school is working on recycled vegetable oil, is that correct, to biodiesel? And that's the cleaner way of doing it. Unfortunately, if it's not something that could be scaled up, it's not something that if we got all of the recycled vegetable oil that could be obtained in the whole country, it turns out it can only meet 5% of our diesel demand. And our diesel demand is about a third of our petroleum demand. So as a scale-upable solution, it doesn't have that much potential. And so I consider it kind of in the category of like good hippie experiment, but not something that we can really put forth as a large-scale solution that can get us off of the oil addiction that we're trying to get off of. And so looking into it, we found that as the reputation, the promotion of biodiesel is growing, and you end up with not just Dickinson College, but Carlisle City and Harrisburg and counties and other levels of government or institutions buying biodiesel, most of them are buying it from refineries that are getting it from soy. And 90%, and that might be a little old, it's probably higher than that now, of the biodiesel in this country is from soy. 87% of that is genetically engineered. And the fact is that when you use genetically engineered soy, that's all genetically engineered so you can spray more Roundup. You have an average of 13% more Roundup herbicide being sprayed, which means more toxic chemicals in the environment. And there was a study just a few years ago from the University of Pittsburgh showing increased deaths to amphibians that are particularly vulnerable to that herbicide. And so when we're fueling up with this green fuel that's supposedly homegrown and secure and all these things, that's just one of many things you have to look at, not to mention how much land do we have to apply to this, where is the energy to grow it actually coming from. And when you tie this into natural gas, because to grow something, soy, corn, corn is for ethanol, soy is for biodiesel, to grow either of those things or other biofuels, you need fertilizer. Because our soil is being depleted, you can't grow things in an intensive way without fertilizers. And fertilizers are made from three things. One of them is nitrogen. Now, our nitrogen-based fertilizer production is from natural gas. And since we're running out of natural gas, which we mentioned earlier, and starting to have to get from other countries, and that's a little difficult, you have to have these big cryogenic tanker ships and stuff, but fertilizer is easier to make overseas. So half of our fertilizer production is already, just in the past handful of years, gone overseas, chasing the natural gas supply, to the same unstable countries that we make unstable through our military policy, to the same countries that we're trying to be secure from, so we're not dependent on that. And so when we move towards biodiesel, ethanol, biofuels, any type of fuel that could be grown, what we're looking at is a fuel that is a foreign fossil fuel, because you can't grow it without those foreign fossil fuels, and we're making ourselves dependent on some of the same places we're trying to avoid. You'll find, and let's go through all the major energy categories. You have, okay, nuclear power, that's domestic, right? We make it here, but where's the uranium come from? About 90% of our uranium is imported. That doesn't sound very domestic to me. Coal, we're the Saudi Arabia of coal in the U.S. We have more than any other country. We have 200 years left, they say. In reality, we have until about 2032 before coal production peaks. And coal production east of the Mississippi already peaked in 1999. And we're already facing the fact that we're importing about 2% or so, 2 to 3%, but our imports are increasing 20% when our domestic production capability is increasing only 1% a year. So that trend, we have coal industry analysts just as recently as December publishing reports and putting news wires out saying, U.S. coal supply falling short? That was the name of the press release. Okay. And this is the thing that we supposedly have 200 years of, don't worry, we're not going to run out. The fact that the prices could keep going up because they're trying to use more and more of it, and that production might peak within the lifetime of the plants they're trying to build so they can't even pay them off, that's a serious energy security issue. And the places we're already importing coal from, Colombia, Venezuela, and Indonesia are the top three. Stable places, right? Some of the same places we go after for oil. Natural gas, same story. We're about 2 to 3% of imports right now, but our goal by 2020-ish is to be at around 20% imports if they build all these import terminals, so we can get it from some of the same unstable places that we have to attack to get their oil. And oil, of course, we're importing, actually, I have that in here. We're importing two-thirds of our oil. Man, this is my collage of pictures for oil. Half of our import oil is from Americas, the Americas, Canada, Mexico, Venezuela. It's on this side of the pie. But 17% from the Middle East, and the Africa has now taken over. We actually have more from there than the Middle East now. But they're very unstable areas, and we make them unstable through our foreign policy, because we spend so much money going to war. Half of our federal budget, that's discretionary spending, goes to current or past military expenditures, which is as much as the rest of the world combined. So energy security-wise, we can't get there with oil, obviously. We can't get there with natural gas. We can't even get there with coal. We definitely can't get there with uranium. There's not enough left in the world. We're starting to run out, and prices of that are going through the roof as well. And we can't get there with biofuels. Biofuels are also a fossil fuel importing issue. So where are we going to get our energy from? The easiest solution, jumping to another presentation here. This is my presentation on Beyond Oil. Oh, here's oil prices tripled just since the late 90s when they were pretty stable up to that point. Natural gas tripled the same as well in that time. Coal prices have doubled. But aside from tripling our fuel economy and doing all these conservation and efficiency tactics that we need to be doing, the answer we're going to find in the transportation heating fuel sector is getting off of burnable fuels altogether. And we take a pretty hardcore position on a lot of issues, mostly because we have to protect all the communities that are impacted by those technologies. We don't compromise on things and say this set of communities can get poisoned in order for a policy to pass, because we're accountable to all the communities that we're working with. So pretty much anything that ends up burning anything that needs any kind of feedstock, we've analyzed and found a lot of problems with. We found that there's alternatives to them, and we advocate for those alternatives, and we do that pretty relentlessly. And in that sector, we found electric vehicles are the only thing that really have the long-term potential to get us where we need to as far as the alternatives. Of course, we need to drive less and have all those conservation efficiency tactics as well. But if Dickinson really wants to be ahead of the curve on transportation, it would jump straight over the biodiesel thing and talk about getting the fleet onto plug-in hybrids and full electric vehicles. Those vehicles have already existed on the streets of California in just the past couple of years. Unfortunately, a lot of them, the car companies bought back and crushed up because the mandate was altered in that state. But they're starting to come back. We're actually holding soon, this summer, the first workshop in the east part of the country on how to train, it is a workshop to train tech school teachers how to get their students converting normal cars to electric vehicles. So you can bring in your old car, gut the engine, get that out of there entirely, and put electric batteries in the engine and have a commuter vehicle that will do all the needs you'll have for a campus fleet and for most commuters. About 90% of commuters will have the range to get you where you need to go as well. And so the answers for that are here now. There's folks in Austin, Texas that already have electric cars and they can plug them in and buy wind power so they can power them with wind. And it costs the equivalent of less than $1 a gallon of gasoline. So you can't beat that. That's pretty affordable. The only thing that's not affordable right now is the electric car itself. And we need to create the demand for that by starting to actually pioneer it and show that's possible and get the market built for it so that they start mass producing them, which is how you bring the price down on almost all of these things. So I think I'll leave it there. Am I at 20 minutes now? Is that right? Okay. So if folks have questions, I guess.
Okay, what we'll do is, let's open this up to the community here. But first, I want to give Tom a chance to respond to Mike, and Mike a chance to respond to Tom if you have anything to say. And then we'll open it up to questions and discussion.
I mean, you know, as is apparent, Mike and I position differently. I admire that future vision. It's just that I think it's tough to get to real quick. And it may be some other future vision as we go forward. So again, where I position is I'm trying to make things happen in the next 20 months. Kim can tell you. And Mike in his presentation would talk about wind energy being very good. And I spend about half of my time in wind energy. Well, guess what? The last 2 days, I spend focused on people that don't want wind energy because they see problems with it. And guess what? I'm the first one to confess every one of these things has problems. It's a question of, for me, wind energy has far less problems than many of these other things. So what I'm attempting to do is to inch forward now and to learn as we go. And that's kind of my take on it. Mike? How we differ, right?
Sure. So I guess to address that, in order to draw the line in the sand, figure out, okay, what's the difference between clean and dirty technologies? And our position has had to evolve in response to what we're finding out in communities, because we started off, I never imagined I would be fighting coal or fighting natural gas. I started off with landfills, incinerators, and I was happy fighting that, and that was enough to take care of. But as more communities are starting, like in the late 90s, there are about 70 natural gas power plants they try to build in this state. And so groups are calling me like, Mike, help us out. I was like, okay, natural gas. Everyone's like, cleaner, it must be good. So I researched it. I was like, okay, yeah, there's some serious problems with that. And so I figured, okay, if I'm against natural gas, and obviously we're against coal and nukes and all these other dirty things, then what are we for? And I had to really flesh out the solutions. And the squeezed down to 2-page version of that is what you have in your hands on that clean energy solutions fact sheet. And we found that we don't need any of the things, any of the burnable technologies out there. And the line that we like to draw is one where if there's a smokestack, it's not necessary. If it requires a feedstock, if you have to grow something, waste something, burn something, dispose of something afterwards, it's not sustainable. It's harming communities, And there are alternatives. If there were no alternatives, I'd be like, okay, well, what's the least damaging one? And let's cope with that and reduce our need for it. But thankfully, on almost all of the stuff, there's alternatives. Now, for industrial heating purposes, they still have to burn things for that until we find ways, other than just being more efficient, to not have to burn things for that application. But in pretty much every energy sector other than that, there are non-burn technologies, there are non-nuclear technologies that could be used for that, and that's where we advocate because we don't want to see any communities getting hurt.
Okay,
but
great.
My suggestion would be that we move the comments not to having Mike and I continue to debate each other because we'll never agree on this, but questions that you may have on either of our points anything else.
We're going to go right to questions and answers and discussion, and Katie here has a couple of announcements she has to make about how we're going to handle this as far as the microphone goes.
We just have microphones, so please raise your hand and we will bring a microphone to you.
My question is, you talked about landfills and the high mercury levels, one of you did, and it was mentioned several times. Where are the high mercury levels coming from?
There have been a handful of studies that have been put out by Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee since 1999. They study mercury in the waste stream. The primary source of them, and this is a little bit ironic because it gets into critiquing something that we're generally in favor of, is fluorescent bulbs. Compact fluorescent bulbs as well also have mercury in them. And when they break in the waste stream, they end up not only in transfer stations, all the other components, but ultimately at the landfill. When you have all that organic matter that breaks down to methane, that methane helps other things escape. Many of them are toxic chemicals. Mercury is one of many that are in there. Vinyl chloride and all these other things are in there as well. But the mercury concentrations that they found in landfill gas when it's burned, or even without burning it, the concentration that's in there is comparable to what they find in coal plants. And that's not counting the rest of the landfill that's not even able to capture, because all that gas is not captured, only some of it is. So it's very dangerous stuff.
The other source that people would refer to is from coal-fired generation, and the mercury comes up in the atmosphere. So that if you go to lakes in Pennsylvania or New York, you'll find that there are fish warnings, don't eat such and such fish. That's not from the compact fluorescent light bulbs. That's from the mercury that's transported atmospherically. It settles out, and then the methylation of mercury goes on, as Mike has described, and goes up the food chain. So one of the things that you've just seen, and we helped to fight for it, is new mercury regulations for coal-fired generation in Pennsylvania. Now, by itself, that's not going to do it, because we're still getting a bunch from Ohio. But you know how you start this? Is you have to start in one place and make something happen, and then it moves to the other place and the other place. Remember when we had to take lead out of gasoline? Lead was a significant neurotoxin, and it was a big deal getting it out of the environment. Remember reading about Mad Hatters? Mad Hatters used mercury to felt the hats. Mercury is a significant environmental toxin. So on a very broad scale, we just want to try and get it out of the environment.
I wanted to ask a question and say something about landfill gas, because most of our students have a chance to visit a landfill, and we see that the gas there, which is partially methane, 50% methane, is being flared. It seems to me a lot easier to keep the toxics out of the landfill, like mercury and so forth, that you're concerned about, than the alternative, which is, if we don't want us to flare that gas, whether we get electricity from it or not, and not burn it, then what we have is a situation of releasing massive amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Mike, what would you have us do with our landfills right now in terms of the gas coming off them? Flare it, don't flare it.
Okay, well, first is to dodge that question the way it's framed, because the real issue is that we need to not just get the toxins out of it, which are not just the bulbs, but mercury fillings from dentistry and a lot of other things as well have mercury in them. But to get organics out of the landfill, which is something that a lot of other countries have figured out is the way to go, because you don't want to mix your organics, which is what causes the methane generation, with all these other things that have so many more toxins in them, so that you end up creating this toxic brew of landfill gas that is often just described as methane, but it's full of hundreds of toxic chemicals. And a lot of that is never captured and leaks out. But what is captured, you can flare it or you can burn it to create electricity. But either way, they tend not to filter the toxins out first. And what we've been advocating, in addition to the larger scale, get the organics out kind of answers and get the toxins out and all that stuff, is to filter the gas before you burn it instead of counting the stuff as green energy and subsidizing poor waste management practices in the first place, because you don't have comparable subsidies for recycling and stuff when you have this energy policy that say this is green but something else isn't. But also get the toxins out of there so that when you burn it, it is mostly methane being burned and not methane and mercury and vinyl chloride and TCE and all that stuff.
The question I'd ask for both of you is, of all the alternative technologies we have for energy production, what do you think will be the most likely to catch on and be most effective in the near future?
Well, the one we need the most is efficiency, and with the right incentives, we'll have it. We've had very poor efficiency programs in Pennsylvania. That is always the best solution. Beyond that, it's wind, clearly. Wind, you know, and I... Don't use this against me. In every new technology area, you need a, don't use this, killer application. You need a leading edge technology. Wind is the leading edge renewable energy technology by far and away. It's moving the fastest. It has no fuel. So there's no pollution, there's no carbon, and the cost stays the same for the life of the project. That said, there are problems with wind energy. Every one of these things has problems. There's costs with all of this. But I think the answer to me would clearly be wind.
Yeah, I agree.
We agreed.
Yeah, congratulations.
Mike, you said that you think electric cars are kind of one of the answers, but... At the same time, wind and solar won't really be able to fuel all our energy needs. So what else? I mean, like, if you're going to plug in your car to wind energy, do you think that, I mean, everyone would be able to do that?
Yes. There have been documents out for at least 1 to 2 decades now showing that the wind potential alone in this country is enough to power the country many times over. Now, we're not literally going to build all the wind turbines in the Dakotas and put power lines out to the coast and do that kind of crazy scheme, or the similar scheme of 100 square miles in Nevada could power the whole country in solar. You know, like that, that would theoretically be true, but it would be kind of silly to do it exactly that way. But what the Department of Energy has done, and they've looked at this numerous times, just on solar alone, I think some of this is in that fact sheet, if you distribute it so that's a bit in each state, you'd have 17 square miles on average in each state of solar. And just the brownfields, the abandoned industrial areas in all of our cities around the country are enough land to make us 100% solar powered in this country. And that's just solar. So that's not including cutting our energy demand in half with conservation and efficiency and then using as much wind and as much solar as we can. So if we did all of those things, that can meet all of our energy needs. And then you get into the issue of, oh, is it, what are you doing when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining and the intermittency issues? And that's when some kind of storage tactic is going to be necessary when we get to high enough percent that we even have to start worrying about that. And that's when maybe hydrogen would make sense in the energy realm. It doesn't make sense in cars, but it could make sense when you have extra wind and extra solar being generated to split hydrogen into oxygen and, split water into hydrogen and oxygen and store that hydrogen, turn it back into water, and get the electricity less than you put in, but get it back later when you need it. So that's one of multiple possible storage tactics that could be the way out for making sure that we can run our economy just on wind and solar and maybe some small amounts of other intermittent renewable technologies.
Now, this is a wonderful example of how you can respect each other and like each other, but differ. My answer would be top end of wind is 20%. Solar, much less than that. We need to bring much more efficiency in. I don't know all the pieces coming forward. And I'm not suggesting that's not a wonderful vision, but if you were to ask me, is that a near-term and obtainable vision, I'd say I don't see it. And if I look at the countries that have the most wind and have kind of peaked out, they're kind of at like 20%. So I wish that I agreed with that, and I respect the opinion, don't misunderstand me, but I'd have to answer differently.
Okay. There's one other point I wanted to say on the potential for us, in the back of my head, I was trying to get it out. Earlier this year? Yeah. The Bush administration's own Department of Energy had a draft report that they have not released, unfortunately, but it was on the web, it was in Google Cache for a few days, and we pulled it out of there. And it's looking at the potential for renewable energy in this country, and they included biomass and other things that we don't consider to be really renewable, but even if you just look at the wind and solar pieces of that, you'll see that by 2020, this is only not even 15 years away, they were saying it's possible to meet more than all of our energy needs just with those technologies, if you actually look into that report and include some of the conservation efficiency information that's also out there, including from the same agency. This is even Bush's Department of Energy saying that the capability is there to do that. Now, there's intermittency issues that could be debated as far as can we store it, can we get over a certain percentage because of that. But aside from that, the potential for having enough solar, having enough wind, there's no question about that. That's been answered many times over.
And as of this moment, we're going to bet a pitcher of Yingling on that.
I don't drink alcohol, so I don't know about the Yingling thing. But...
buttermilk.
I don't do dairy either.
Okay.
Too much dioxin.
Can you put up with this? I mean, both of us. I don't mean Mike.
Yes, Will Folkshag. I represent sort of indirectly an organization called Heritage Hydro, Heishman's Mill. We're doing studies at Bucknell on modernizing the water wheel and so on. And my question is, in these discussions, and I've gone through this in the 70s as an engineer.
18 or 19?
In the 70s?
Yeah, 1870s or 1970s.
Well, actually both.
Okay.
And that's another lecture. But I want to know, the big fashion in the 70s was, I've gone through the same discussions for a decade back then. What's become of hydro? What's become of small hydro? It seems to be the absolutely invisible.
The big hydro stuff in Pennsylvania, we've got on the order of 2,500 megawatts of hydro. Most of it's on the Susquehanna River.
Yeah.
The small hydro stuff is back in the 100-year-ago period. To rehab and bring those projects back to me is terrific, but it's small stuff. So well, contribution to this overall big problem.
Yeah,
I'd love to see it.
There are other facts besides energy generation in that, and I'd like to talk to you afterwards. Huh?
There is one other fact that, and you can find this on our website under the hydro section. There was actually some of the information came out of Penn State where they were studying one of the small dams that was removed in Lancaster County near here. And they were looking at the microinvertebrates, I think it was, or some kind of aquatic life, above and below the dam before and after it was removed. And they found stark differences before, but after there was enough oxygen flow going through there, the downstream part of it bounced back to life. And so dam removal is an important environmental objective. And in the case of things that are so small that we're not going to generate a lot, or it would do more for the environment to just remove these small dams, I would favor that personally. Hydropower can make sense if you're not damming the whole width of a water body or if it's ocean-based or something where you're not having so much of an impact. But blocking a whole water body is a pretty serious thing to be doing to a river or stream. So.
Mr. Ewell, on one of your slides, your electric cars, you said that they tend to go 20 to 60 miles on a single battery. Is there any research ongoing to expand that capacity that might make it more practical for Americans who drive further distances or industries like the trucking industry that rely on long-distance hauls?
Right. The numbers in there, I actually added a more recent version and put higher numbers because it depends on who you ask and how many batteries they're putting in the car. So the main thing is partially the battery technology. You get different range numbers for different companies, and also it depends on how much the vehicle weighs will affect that a lot. So it's really, like, part of it's the technology, part of it's the number of batteries in the way of the car, and you have to combine those. And some of the numbers I've seen out there, some of the newer things that are being promoted are talking as high as 200, 250 mile ranges. Now, that's not going to work for the truckers. I don't know how electric vehicles are going to be a good solution for the truckers other than going as far as they can and refueling, but it's not going to take them very far because there's a lot more weight. And I think the real answer is that we need to have more local production, more local consumption, like getting our food locally, not from California, and then getting as much long-haul stuff as we can onto trains rather than assuming that a lot of this has to go by truck still.
So.
Yeah, I can say a little bit about that also. The Stanford University, is, as MIT and others, are doing a lot of research on battery-driven vehicles now. Even the Bush administration is putting some money into this. They have a battery now that weighs close about 100 pounds that's good for a two-passenger vehicle that's over 100 miles. The average commute in this country, a lot of gas goes for commuting, is under 60 miles, and that includes California. And so we have a long way to go just with the commuter car. And a battery-driven commuter car makes a lot of sense. Now, people are concerned about how safe those cars are when they're driving with Humvees next to them and SUVs and so forth. But my solution is to ban those cars or raise the price of gas so high that they can't afford to drive them anymore.
There's a whole market acceptance of this stuff. I happen to agree that there's a role for electric vehicles. And I mentioned to both mics earlier today when I was in the running the Sustainable Energy Fund. Same time I invested in a wind company, I invested in an electric vehicle company. The wind company was a runaway success, you know, purchased by another company. The electric vehicle company went bankrupt. Not because it wasn't good technology, not because there wasn't a need. It's acceptance. And I mean, there's a whole behavioral and market acceptance thing that's part of what we're facing and addressing. And how you work through that, and how you get people to buy into pieces of this, I don't think any of us have any answers. That's a big issue in everything we're talking about.
I would encourage anyone who hasn't seen it to get a copy of the documentary that came out last year called Who Killed the Electric Car? That documentary alone is a good advertisement for it, but it explains how just in California, just in the past few years, they've had a lot of these on the road. They did a very poor marketing campaign. The car companies sabotaged the program as much as they could. But there's still a lot of demand for it, and people wanted them. They fought not to get the cars taken back and crushed up. They fought and campaigned to keep them because they were so good. So I think there will be a lot of acceptance if they actually put them out there again, and there is a campaign to do that.
Let me just tell the poop to power story.
Oh, boy. I'm going to respond to that one.
In Pennsylvania, we have cows, and if you haven't noticed, they poop. And you can take and you can collect, digest, produce methane gas, and produce power from it. You're also at the same time solving a water quality problem, a runoff problem. You're solving a nuisance odor problem. Whatever you think of that, just buy it for a minute. Now let's go to the typical farm. And by the way, these are going to be the big farms, so that's a different issue. But ignore that for a moment. The big farms can produce twice the amount of power that they consume by taking and digesting their cow poop. The rules are such, though, that you can't do it because the utilities will still charge you for the overhead lines. They'll still charge you for standby charges. They'll charge you for special processing fees. So that even if you produced twice the power you consumed, you would still pay 3/4 of the bill you were paying before. That's not behavior in the market. That's rules protecting the monopoly utilities. Now, by the way, after 3 years, we got those rules changed. So you can now do that. But just an example of the obstacles that are in front of us in many of these things. And there's all kinds of market obstacles in moving forward. And if anybody, including me, tells you they know the way to do all this or that there's one answer, it's wrong. There's going to be many answers. Some are going to be wrong. We just need to be doing things and understanding and learning and trying to move forward. That's my take.
Okay. I have to give the other side of that.
Yeah.
And you'll find this on our website, too. Look up that address and look at the digesters page. Just go /digesters, and you'll get there. National Sierra Club, the Grace Factory Farm Project, and a lot of the factory farm opponents here in Pennsylvania have been livid about digesters. And I mean, digesters I put on the cleanest end of the dirty things you can burn, and it's at the bottom on that chart. And it's not full of all the toxins and other things that so many other of these combustibles are. But the folks that are fighting these factory farms, I mean, I've never seen a level of outrage that I've seen. It was directed at Penn Future, actually, at the time, on some of the email lists of these folks that are like, what are you, crazy promoting digesters? We're fighting these things. This is just subsidizing these large animal factory operations. And essentially, they're subsidizing their waste management handling. And so I have some issues with that. You'll see that some of the things that they're supposedly solving in terms of odor and waste management, all these other problems, that they're not as much of a solution as they're cracked up to be, and that's already been thoroughly critiqued by some of those groups I mentioned. You'll find that in the documents on our website that we link to from those organizations. And basically, and this gets, I'll get even more controversial before you jump back on me.
Okay. Good.
The ultimate answer here, and this is a serious energy issue, is what we choose to eat. And are we wanting to subsidize animal production through our renewable energy policies rather than subsidizing wind and solar and conservation and efficiency? And do we want to be doing that for type of food production that is very energy intensive in the first place? Meat production and dairy production are extremely energy intensive. You have to grow a lot of things that you normally have to grow to feed people if you're feeding them plant products directly, and then cycle a lot of that through animals, wasting huge amounts of that energy in the process just to eat that in the form of meat. Now, I know it's a very controversial thing to go out and point and say, you shouldn't eat animal products, you shouldn't consume dairy. That is something that people in this country are not ready to hear, unfortunately. However, from an environmental perspective and just a straight-up economic perspective, you're not going to have a choice at some point, because there's companies like Purdue already. Is it Purdue or Tyson? I think it might be Tyson. They're already complaining to the ethanol industry that the prices of poultry are going to go up because of the demand for corn from ethanol. We are already on the brink of facing a fuel versus food debate. We're already about to start importing ethanol from Brazil. So they're not going to have their own fuel versus food thing, because feeding our cars is going to be more important to U.S. policy than making sure Brazilians can feed themselves. And that is a real circumstance in this country and nation or globally. And the energy production that goes into that, with all the stuff with the fertilizer and all that, like, that is a serious thing. The cost of meat production, if we're going to try to continue this high energy lifestyle, is going to keep going up, as well as all the oil, gas, and other commodities go up. So it's going to get to a point where you might like your meat, you might like your dairy products, but at some point you're going to have to look at your wallet and decide whether it's worth it, because that's what it's going to come down to. And so I think a smart thing to do would not only be look at our dietary issues now, but look at our energy policies and see if we want to be subsidizing that sort of food production.
Now, do you see why I say that you can make a career here? Because you can see the differences of opinion. And this is a good example. Now, the work that we did for the farms brought in net metering, which allows any kind of energy production distributed, not just farms. However, there are pieces of the ag community that thought we were wonderful because of this. As Mike can tell you, there are other pieces of the ag community that think we're horrible and demonize us because we're questioning antibiotics in animal feed. And we have six attorneys that work with us, and one of the things we do is enforce laws. Well, guess what? We're litigating against some of the same big farms that we're trying to bring the energy solution to. So this is a very complex kind of thing. There's all kinds of dimensions to it. The only thing I can tell you, honestly, this is a huge thing that's going to go on for decades. It's a good place to form a career. That's all I care about tonight. I want to get some of you people doing this.
Guess we'll make it, I guess, any other questions? If not, what we're going to do is Mike mentioned to me to tell the students in particular, he's going to stick around. Whatever issue you're working on in your classes that has anything to do with the environment, somewhere in his folder down here, he has a flyer for you or a website for you. And Tom mentioned that if you want to talk a little bit about future careers in the area of energy and so forth, which they're very diverse as represented in our audience tonight, there's at least half a dozen different energy-related careers represented, or professionals here in the audience. Tom will stick around, too, to meet with you. So I think with that, please join me in welcoming me. Are you going to close up? In fact, our official close.
On behalf of the Clark Center, Clark Forum, I would like to thank all of our speakers for coming and being a part of this discussion tonight. And as a token of our appreciation, we have a plaque for them.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
Ooh.
Thank you very much.